Univariate data cleaning won't be enough because we have to worry about bivariate outliers. A univariate outlier, by definition, is a case that influences or gives us a poor estimate of a univariate statistic. A bivariate outlier, by definition, is a case that screws up a bivariate statistical analysis and decision. And you can have every combination you can think of. Sit there and draw circles and dots, and you can come up with all combinations. So here we have a data set with fine skewness, and we do the outlier analysis, and we see there's no outliers in either X or Y. Again, very clever variable names. I pride myself in my variable names. I got a correlation of 0.19, and when I plot it, I get this. Because brothers and sisters, this does not look like a 0.19. But this does. Remember what the correlation does. Now, the correlation doesn't actually draw little circles. We know that. But it is as if it expanded the envelope, not from the majority of the data, but the whole data, while holding it that symmetrical football-y sort of shape. Of course, we say football. It's really more like a rugby ball, a little shorter. We're all thinking, please God, not a soccer ball. That's done. So the question is, what is our better description of what's going on in the population? With or without them? Probably. So, how do we go looking for them? Because we already tried and didn't find them. I mean, we looked at them and we found, well, we have no skewing, we have no outliers, everything's fine, but it's not. And to be totally honest, what most people do is they say, I want to see what it looks like without them. Now, what do you do when there's cases in here and in here? Well, one thing you can do is make a professional decision. That can be difficult when it's when it's 10 of 50 correlations that then lead to layers and layers of multivariate analysis. So what we can do is we can use a technique that we already have to identify outliers, bivariate outliers, by an algorithm. That's what comforts people. Because an algorithm is hypothesis blind. You run the algorithm, you take the results, because the algorithm is designed to make our data more representative and better conform and comport itself to the statistical analyses we're about to do. But it's not human decision making. It's particularly not researcher, hypothesis driven, researcher based decision making. That's what we're really trying to avoid. So here's a process we can do. We take Y and X and we plug them into a multiple regression. The reason we're putting them into a multiple regression, even though we only have one predictor, is because we can get the residual. The residual is the difference between a person's real Y score and the Y score based on X. A residual means the model doesn't fit you. Now take a look at this picture again. These people are fit by this linear model way better than those. Literally, what we're looking for is a way to objectively identify people that the model doesn't fit, because they, by definition, are bivariate outliers. So, we run the model, we get the unstandardized values, we get Tukey's hinges on the residual, and we do an outlier analysis on the residuals. Residual values that are too big or too small probably don't belong in the sample that represents the bulk of the people. So we apply this and then we trim. Before, we get a correlation of 0.19. After, we get a correlation of 0.47. The process meets our criteria of hypothesis blind. The next thing I want to know is I want to know who those three people are and what I can learn from them. When outlier analysis first became popular, one of Mosteller's students did his dissertation by going back through some of the early people who applied bivariate outlier analysis and following up on the people who were identified as outliers, as bivariate outliers. What he discovered is that bivariate outliers led to 4 new constructs and 15 new relationships between variables. Because something's going on here. There's a reasonable relationship, but this person is odd. They have an unbelievably low, have lower score than anywhere here, higher score than anybody there. Let's go find out who they are. Let's go see if there's more of them and see what else is going on in that subgroup. They went back into, Mosteller's student went back into these data sets and searched for people who were like them, did fancy analyses on them, interviewed an awful lot of them, and found out that that's what other researchers had been doing. They were taking their outliers and they were following up on them. Outlier analyses are useful because they clean up our current data, are more likely to give us a population representative set of results, and also the outliers may be the coolest people we find in the study. Following up on outliers is really useful. Yes? This?
Yeah, applying the formulas we get.
Sure. Well, this was sort of a... What I did is I took these hinges and plugged them in here and got back the values of negative 13.15 and 14.15.
I'm good with that.
And then I put those into a select cases. Select anybody who's between those two values. And when we select those people, we get what the middle of the distribution looked like. You get exactly the same result if you look at those three people and say, well, you don't belong. Sit over here for a while we analyze your friends. You get exactly the same result. But it's nice to have an automated algorithm where you're not making pointing decisions. That's why I wanted to show you this. So what about ANOVA? The situation in ANOVA is that ANOVA is not about one distribution from one population. Every condition in a study has the purpose of representing something. And so my treatment distribution is representing one thing, and my control distribution is representing something else. Each set of data representing something needs to be looked at independently, be looked at separately for outliers and skewness. If we have a too large outlier in my control group, we're likely to identify it as an outlier, even if we put all the data in together. But if we have a too large outlier on this distribution, that's not going to be identified if we use all the data together. So what we have to do is do 2 outlier analyses, one on each group. And so here we have a mean difference of about 2 that's not statistically significant. We split the data into 2 files. We go get Explore. It cranks it out twice. Here is for group 1. Here it is for group 2. We apply those hinges into the computator, get back the boundaries. We decide that there are no outliers in the Z1 group. and there's at least one too small outlier here. Just one case. Just one case. We go in and we trim. I'm going to show you a more elaborate version of the trimming. But we go in and we trim and we say, anybody that's in Z1 is good because it has no outliers. If you're in Z2, then you need to be higher than the minimum value. So this grabs everybody we need, and now you'll notice that we get a 4-point difference that's statistically significant. Which one do we prefer? We prefer the trimmed one, because we are going to believe, 50 years of analysis, the trimmed data on average are more representative than raw data. We can play the same game by Windsorizing. Z1 doesn't have any outliers, so if you're in Z1, the Windsorized score is your original score. If you're in group 2 and you're above the threshold, then that's your score. If you're below the threshold, your new score is the threshold. And when we plug that in, we also get a significant result. And if we were asked, as you will be on the homework, I know, I wrote it, which of these three data sets you prefer the Windsorized. Just for now, just say it so that I know you heard me. What do you really prefer? Depends on the research community you go back to. That is always the final arbitrator of what you do until or unless you decide to go to war. Now, I've done it. I kind of like it, but I'm not suggesting it as an early career technique. Now, let me show you a more complete version of trimming and Windsorizing in ANOVA. What we did in that last one was to base everything on selecting cases. Some people like to have a variable that's cleaned up and then operate on that variable. Absolutely, here we go. So here's our starting data. We have the scores, the IV scores, the means. We have, so this is the, we're going to trim separately for each group. And so here's for DV1 and for DV2. We plug these into the computators for group 1. We have 9 and 13 as our hinges. We get back 3 and 19 as our boundaries. For group 2, we plug in hinges of 26 and 29. We get back boundaries of 21.5 and 33.5. So for this group, anything outside of 3 to 19 is going to be modified. For this group, anything outside of 21.5 and 33.5 is going to be operated on. Here's how to do this within RECODE. We are going to trim, we're going to build a variable out of DV called DVTrim. Click on old and new values. Now, we're used to putting this in, clicking change, and then clicking old and new values, right? We're not going to do that now. We're going to put this in and we're going to click if. We're going to do our RECODEs conditionally. First, we're going to do it on group 1. Then we're going to come back and do it on group 2. And I want to show you why this confuses the shit out of people. So, it says group 1. If IV group equals 1, then we click continue. Then we click old and new variables and we tell it. If it's missing, it's missing. Lowest through 2.9 is missing. 19.1 through highest is missing. Everything else retains its value. Continue. Okay. But we're not done. What about the other group? In a moment. Because it only lets you do one if at a time. Because when you go through all of this, it generates one code of syntax. The system won't generate multiple codes at a time, so you generate one at a time. And so, this is what it looks like after what we just did. We only get variable scores for people in group one because we said, just operate on people from group one. And it listened. This person that has a value that's too big got trimmed. How we doing? Now we got to go back in and do the other group by resetting the if and by resetting the boundaries. So we come back in. When we click on recode, it's going to come back to here. Click on if, and now put in group two. Continue. Now old and new values, and put in the boundaries for group two. Continue. Okay. And now we have a complete set of data that have been trimmed with different trimming values for the two groups. How are we doing? When we play this same game, oh, then here it shows you the consequence of all of this. And this, by the way, shows all of the code that you can use if you want to use code. Some people like code. Here's code. I like code. Winds are rising. Another variable name. Same process. We set it up for group one first. Now, values that are outside of the boundary get changed into the most extreme acceptable value. We get this. Notice we have a score for everybody. The one that was too big got turned into the largest acceptable value. Back in, group two. Another set of values, and now we have everybody. And here we have for the raw and the winds rised. You can see that it moves things around a little bit. And here's the code. The if statements makes things a little hard to see what the hell SPSS is doing. Remember, whenever you use the graphical user interface, you're clicking buttons, pushing things around, then you said okay, and it writes syntax for you and submits that syntax to the program. It can only write one line at a time. So we have to write one line for the group one and a second line for the group two, which is why we have to do it two times, one for each. Oh, that's not what I wanted. So, that's a couple of days on transformation and data cleaning.